I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American C-17 military planes are delivering humanitarian aid to the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, today, as ordered by President Bush yesterday. In Washington, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said today that the U.S. will only provide aid and will not use military force in the conflict between Russia and its former Soviet republic. In Moscow, Russia's foreign minister responded to President Bush's concerns about Georgia's sovereignty by saying that the world can, quote, forget about Georgia's territorial integrity. Los Angeles Times Pentagon correspondent Julian Barnes joins us from Washington. And Julian, how significant is this rhetoric between Washington and Moscow?
Well, I'm not sure it's that significant. Officials in Washington were dismissing it as bluster this morning. We'll have to see how it plays out over the next couple of days as the U.S. efforts to aid Georgia step up.
Now, President Bush yesterday did announce some humanitarian aid going into Georgia and other things, but some are saying that those are just modest measures, which really sort of underscore limited options that the U.S. has to deal with this conflict.
Well, I think that that's right, that these are pretty limited. I mean, the initial humanitarian aid is very modest. We had two C-17 flights. Now, that may pick up as the assessment team on the ground figures out what else the United States can do, but it does underscore the problems with the United States doing anything. The problem for Washington is how to support Georgia without provoking a confrontation with Russia. One proposal we were hearing more from the Pentagon yesterday was efforts to rebuild the Georgian military. Now, that really can't take place until the conflict stops, but it is a signal that Washington is trying to send to Georgia that they are indeed serious about helping.
Sounds as if Washington's in a bind here.
Yeah, I think the initiatives have to be diplomatic. Washington is counting on threats to block Russia from WTO membership and other international trade groups as exerting some leverage over Russia. So far, the Russians haven't reacted to that. But officials you talk to in Washington insist that in the days to come, Moscow will start to back down based on that sort of pressure.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been sent to France for emergency talks with the French president, who helped mediate the truce that obviously isn't holding between Russia and Georgia. Does that do anything?
In Washington, a lot of hardliners felt like this is really too little and too late. They wanted to see a much higher level engagement by the State Department really early on in this crisis. But Rice's trip to Europe is going to be critical. The NATO reaction to Georgia and how much NATO wants to help Georgia is going to be critical in how this whole thing plays out.
Now, President Bush, though, if we just look at the president himself here, he's in an awkward place. He's called Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin a friend. Obviously, the U.S. has interests in Georgia. How does the White House walk that line?
That's exactly right. It's such a difficult position for the White House. You have on one hand Georgia, which was one of the top examples of sort of promoting democracies in former authoritarian countries. On the other hand, the United States is reliant on Russia for a number of different initiatives. We're very dependent on their help with the Iranian nuclear problem. Also, missile defense in Europe. Secretary Gates, Secretary Rice have made two trips to Moscow trying to bring Vladimir Putin on board to the idea that this is not a threat to Russia. Russians aren't buying that. This is going to set back that effort. It's also going to set back efforts to put more pressure on Iran.
Whether it's bluster, whether someone's ignoring someone, all of these back-and-forth accusations, they may not in and of themselves be something hugely significant. But overall, do you think that what we'll see from this is a deterioration of relations between Moscow and Washington?
Absolutely. It would be very hard to, a month from now, 2 months from now, think that relations would be better because Russia has asserted itself in the sort of near abroad, and it puts the United States in an awkward position where our interests in having good relationships with Russia and our interests in promoting emerging democracies are at loggerheads.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In Georgia today, there are reports of more fighting, including explosions and small arms fire near the Georgian town of Gori, and reports that Russian troops may be settling into other parts of Georgia. And another frontier in this fighting is cyberspace. Weeks before the tanks began to roll, security researchers in the U.S. were following an attack against Georgia's internet infrastructure. And shortly after the shooting started last week, Russian cyber attacks had effectively shut down Georgia's internet servers and took control of government websites, including the one belonging to Georgia's president. To help us understand this brave new world of warfare, we're joined by Bill Woodcock. He's research director at Packet Clearinghouse, which is a nonprofit group working to develop global internet networks. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Deborah.
Can you explain exactly what happened to the websites in Georgia and its internet system?
Well, there are basically two parts to this attack. One is intrusions and defacements, and the other is a denial of service attack, DDoS attack. The websites were broken into, and the content of the websites was replaced with other content, which was, Russian propaganda. And the DDoS attack is an attack against the basic infrastructure, which takes away capacity. It uses up internet bandwidth, making it unavailable to people in the country. Mm. So those kind of went hand in hand in this attack. And, of course, it's a war, a battle, not just a one-sided thing. The Georgians also launched a counterattack and took down the Russian state news agency for the better part of a day as well.
Can you tell exactly who's doing what? And it actually is someone who is representing either Russia or Georgia in all of this and doing these things, or just people who are messing around on a computer?
That's very difficult. The nature of it is that on the computer network, if all goes well, you may be able to track the attack back to a specific machine, but there's no way of knowing for sure who was sitting behind that machine or what their intentions were. For that, you need to look in the political sphere and look and see who it is that benefits from an attack and whether they're claiming credit for the attack and whether that claim is disputed or not.
And, you mentioned these intrusions and, websites basically changed. In one case, on the Georgian president's website, I believe, he was compared with photos of Adolf Hitler. Does that fall into the realm of what you're calling cyber warfare?
Yeah, exactly. So that was the very first web defacement of this round of conflict. That was back on the 20th of July, before there was even any ground conflict started. So that first attack was against the website of the president of Georgia. It replaced the contents with a set of pictures comparing public photographs of him to public photographs of Hitler. And then there was a DDoS attack that was paired with that. And it all kind of was left at that for the better part of 2 weeks before many, many more government websites were defaced and the DDoS attack was stepped up, and then the Georgians retaliated, and then the news agencies in Georgia were hit as well.
Hmm. Now these DDoS or denial of service attacks that you're talking about, can they only happen in Georgia, or is Georgia particularly vulnerable?
They happen all over the world all the time, literally hundreds or even thousands every day. And these are not particularly large ones by sort of global standards. The problem is that Georgia is particularly vulnerable. Here in the United States, we have 80 different locations where internet bandwidth is being produced. We have a very resilient infrastructure, fairly resilient infrastructure. In last year's Russian attacks on Estonia and Latvia, those countries, their internet infrastructure in both cases is four times as large as Georgia's internet infrastructure. And in both cases, they have these internet exchange points within their countries as well. Estonia has two and Latvia has one. That's not very many compared to the United States' 80, and it's not very many compared to Russia, which has roughly 15. But it was enough to allow them to withstand the attack in pretty good shape. By comparison, Georgia is completely dependent upon internet capacity brought in from other countries, and the big problem for them is that the country that almost all their internet capacity was coming in from was Russia. So with all of that gone, what they have left is what they had coming in from Turkey, and Turkish Telecom has been doing a pretty good job of standing by them in this conflict and helping them, but they are leaning very hard on Turkish Telecom.
So you say we have 80 different locations where internet bandwidth is produced. How does that compare with other countries?
So the U.S. has more than any other country, but we're also a very large country in terms of size and population. If you look at Europe, Europe has 110 exchange points in a smaller area than our 80. So Europe is actually in better shape than we are by a long shot. And there are individual developed countries in Asia that are far better off than we are on a sort of per capita and density basis also. Japan, Taiwan, South Korea are all better off. And in fact, even China, although they only have four counting Hong Kong, exchange points, the sum of the bandwidth that they're creating is more than ours.
Mm-hmm. Exchange points, can you explain that?
So internet exchange points are the locations where internet service providers come together in one place to exchange traffic with each other. And if you think about it, what you're paying for is the privilege of getting to the entire rest of the internet. So if your service provider loses their connection to the rest of the internet, they're giving you effectively no value. So it's the point of interconnection between internet service providers that the value comes from. It's not being generated within any internet service provider. They can't generate the value autonomously. It only comes from the places where they come together to produce the bandwidth.
If we in the U.S. are, in fact, behind other countries, what does that say about our vulnerabilities then?
The large number of exchange points, 80 exchange points, gives us some resiliency. The problem is that because they are relatively small compared to the big ones in Europe and the big ones in Asia, they're all operating fairly near capacity. That is, none of them have too much excess capacity left, which means that very much like the power grid, in the United States, the internet infrastructure is potentially at risk of a sort of domino effect, a cascading failure from one exchange point to the next. So if we lost, say, two of our largest exchanges, there would be a cascading effect where all of the traffic that had been handled by those exchanges would try to fail over onto smaller exchanges, which in turn would be overwhelmed by it and so forth. And pretty soon we would have, you know, no working infrastructure left. So this is a major area of concern, something that people in the public sector haven't really been given free rein to think about over the last 8 years. So there are a lot of people who are very much looking forward to January and, you know, the opportunity to put some of these plans into effect to make the United States a little bit less vulnerable.
Bill Woodcock is Research Director at Packet Clearinghouse. When we come back, how your computer may be part of someone else's cyber army. And later in the show, to Beijing and a preview of Olympic track and field, which starts tomorrow. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. We're talking about how the military conflict between Russia and Georgia is playing out in cyberspace and what that means for other countries, especially the U.S. With us is Bill Woodcock. He's Research Director at Packet Clearinghouse. And Bill, before the break, you were talking about critical internet infrastructure and how the U.S. is vulnerable, especially compared with other countries like China. Specifically, what are the Chinese doing?
Well, the main thing is they're just building a lot of capacity. That's the main thing that one can do to make oneself resilient in the face of these kinds of attacks is simply to have more capacity available to you than the other guy has to use in his attacks. The whole thing doubles in size every year, and that's something that's very difficult for people to grasp about the internet sometimes, is that it's essentially been nearly doubling in size every year for 30 years. And so we've had 8 years of really not doing much at all our defensive capability in this area, whereas the Chinese have pursued this aggressively. They've had 8 years of more than doubling their capacity.
I've also read that you say that the Chinese think of this as a form of psychological warfare.
Yeah, very much. The United States looks at cyber warfare as an accompaniment to kinetic warfare. That is, if the United States were to launch a ground attack with tanks and so forth against some country, it's quite likely that there would be a component of that which would target some of their command and control systems, perhaps intruding into their systems to try to find troop locations and plans and things like this. But the Chinese go a step further in their theory with a much longer-term view, and they say, well, all that's great, but if you can disrupt the state of mind of the population of the other country, if you can cause them to feel unproductive and consequently to be unproductive, if you can shut the private sector down, then not only is there not money to back military efforts, but also there's no national will to arms.
So when you say that, yes, the United States is vulnerable, are we vulnerable to these interruptions, system interruptions that could knock out the system? Are we vulnerable to websites being altered, or are we vulnerable to a strategy of trying to do some sort of psychological warfare to make people feel insecure about the way their systems are running, or is it all of those things?
Yeah, it's all of those things in combination. I think that when you have a combination of the DDoS attacks and the intrusions, that's when the effect is greatest. I think that the United States has been struggling largely unsuccessfully with the security issues around getting individual machines tightened up. We still have vast numbers of people out there running Microsoft Windows with, you know, sort of unpatched things that are multiply infected with bots that are used to do these attacks. You know, these are just perfectly innocent people sitting in their homes. They just have made a series of bad choices that leave their computer open and vulnerable to attackers who then take those machines over without their knowledge and use them to stage these attacks against third parties.
So I just want to clarify something. If I have an old Windows operating system that for whatever reason has some sort of technical failing, I'm going to say, because I'm not sure what term you used, someone can use my computer unbeknownst to me and hack into some of these other things.
Exactly. So all of these attacks, both the Russian attacks on Georgia and the Georgian attack back on Russia, all of these attacks use what are called botnets. Botnets in the sense of networks of robots, where the robot is a machine that has been compromised, and it's just a regular computer sitting on someone's desk in their home, connected to a DSL line or a cable modem or something like that. But instead of being a secure operating system, it's an unsecure operating system that's been compromised. And these bots are made so that they take over additional machines. So they kind of, these networks of bots grow themselves, and the person, the bot herder, who controls that network, then hires it out for use in these attacks. And the frightening thing is how inexpensive this is. Typically, these attacks are hired out at 4 cents per computer. So if you were to add up all the money spent on the cyber conflict, probably both sides together have spent less than $5,000 on their offensive operations. By comparison, the defense is far more expensive. We really need to take a harder line on this, and we really need to concentrate a lot more on defense so that these kinds of attacks won't have quite the cost-benefit ratio that they do right now.
So would you say that this issue between Georgia and Russia and how this cyber issue has come to light should tell us a couple of things? Maybe the most prominent might be that cyber warfare is really something that all military officials need to be concerned with, because it's with us for the long haul. And also we need to look at technologically preparing for the Internet of the future because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Russian attack on Estonia last May was very much a wake-up call for the militaries and the governments of the world, and many of them started paying attention after that in a way that they really hadn't previously. The problem is that many of them, you know, paying attention or not, don't really have an idea of where to go from there, because unlike past fields of conflict, This one is entirely in the private sector. It's virtual, which means it's not, being played out on an actual field somewhere. The virtual space it's being played out in is one entirely owned by the private sector.
So basically real virtual war games, and in this case, primarily carried out by mercenaries.
Yes, exactly.
Bill Woodcock, research director at Packet Clearinghouse, a nonprofit organization working to develop global internet networks. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Bill.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And while we're on the topic of the internet, tomorrow on Here and Now, Google Street View is now available in Japan. Some bloggers there say the photos are revealing too much about Japanese life. That's tomorrow. Still ahead this hour, some graphic ads against teen drug abuse appear to be working and may soon be airing around the country. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The drug known as methamphetamine, or meth, is one of the most highly addictive drugs out there, which is scaring many parents and, unfortunately, becoming a reality for many young people.
My name is Christina. I'm from Shoto, Montana. I'm 18 years old, and I started doing meth when I was 17. I was homeless. I was stealing from everybody that I knew, that I loved.
Christina is a former meth addict who tells her story in a radio ad produced for a group called The Meth Project. It says ads like these have had a startling effect on curbing meth use. The project began in Montana in 2005. Then the state was ranked fifth in the nation for meth abuse among young people. By 2007, it ranked 39th. And now, the Meth Project is expanding. Chris Rose is executive director of the Meth Project. And Chris, who is your audience for these ads?
The target audience of our ads are teens, 12 to 17-year-olds. That's the primary audience with whom we're trying to interact. Secondarily, young adults, 18 to 24. The reason we chose teens is that in the research that we did, as well as the research we obtained, the average or mean age of first-time use in many rural areas is 12 years old. And so we looked to find a way in which we could interact.
12?
12 years old.
And what you're really trying to do here is prevent first-time use.
That's exactly right. One of the most amazing things to me is part of the research methodology we use or we implement is called the meth use and attitude study to really get a deep understanding of the impact of meth, the attitudes that surround the drug. And so in 2005, on that benchmark survey, almost 70% of teens in Montana said meth was readily available. Surprisingly and unfortunately, 44% saw benefit in using meth, and over a third had been offered meth in the last 30 days. So you have the most addictive drug known on the planet Earth, readily available to teens that see benefits in using it and have been offered it. And the last most startling figure is 25% saw little to no risk in giving it a try. So that's the backdrop of what we had going on in Montana.
Okay, but so there you are now, middle-aged person seeking to take action on all of this. And how do you develop a campaign that's effective to counter all of those forces?
So interestingly, and I don't mean to be overly glib about this, meth is a great product to have to try to unsell. It's addictive. The consequences are accelerated. People know someone in each of these states in which we're building projects that has suffered those consequences. And no one is for this drug. There's no glamorization of meth. And what we found was that one thing is they are really scared of the concept of addiction. So we needed to bring that out in the ads. Two, not unsurprisingly, they're very interested in how they look. So their appearance is top of mind. And they told us loud and clear, do not send out an authority figure and talk down to them. It has peer-to-peer communication. So you'll notice in all of our messaging, we have no chief of police, and I'm not against law enforcement, but they needed to have a peer talking to them. That's the only way in which they trust the message as it comes through.
Are most of the teenagers in those ads, have some of them really truly been meth addicts?
So in the television ads, those are paid actors and actresses. In the radio spots in every state in which we're running, they are recovering addicts. We just go into juvenile halls, to recovery centers, to other places where we have the opportunity to speak with recovering addicts, and we ask them to tell their story. And the amazing thing is, this is not a prompted, scripted radio spot. This is an individual recovering addict telling their story. And so there's nothing more gripping and nothing that is more impactful, again, to teens, to listen to other teens of what were the consequences of trying meth even once.
There are a couple that really stand out that I saw on your website. There's this one that we have a clip of now, and it's titled Everything Else. Let's listen to a clip of that right now.
Hey, what about me?
Hey, what about you?
Oh, come on.
Give her some.
Yeah, give me some.
All right, all right. You want meth, kid? Here's your meth. And here's your meth dealer. And your meth boyfriends. And your meth baby. And don't forget your meth face.
I have to say, really, really disturbing for the most part, Chris, yet you're saying effective.
You have to look through the eyes of a teen at these commercials to determine the graphic nature being too disturbing or acceptable. Secondly, when you look at the media access and the images they see, whether it's in computer gaming or the internet, we had to find a way to cut through the clutter, but we needed to do so in a believable way. So in areas where meth is a significant issue, what you heard or what you see, they know somebody that's gone through that. And we have had no feedback from teens that we're being sensationalistic with this campaign. They feel it is what the problem is, and they feel that they have to be talked to in that manner.
You know, there are a lot of drugs that we hear about out there, certainly heroin, cocaine, crack cocaine, all of these things that are highly addictive. We've also heard all the stories about this rise in prescription drug abuse on the part of teenagers. Why focus on meth?
There was, in 2004, 2005, when you looked at the statistics, they were overwhelming. In some states, you had 10, 12, 13% of teens, high school students, admitting to meth use. You had extraordinary costs socially and economic. In Idaho and Montana, over 50% of foster care cases were meth related. So we looked at that as a critical issue, and we looked at it as an issue that had a lot of momentum in terms of the growth of the drug. And you could look at statistics that said if this trajectory of this curve continues, this drug accelerates so quickly through a community, we, not just in Montana or Idaho, but across this country, would have a very, very large problem. And secondly, this was just such a misunderstood drug. It was being associated with party or entertainment, where it is the most addictive drug we know about. And the consequences physically, emotionally, to the brain, in terms of brain chemistry changes, are extraordinary, and they're accelerated. If you look at the addictive process over the course of a six-month or a year process, you go from somebody that's a healthy, vibrant individual to somebody that has significant health issues, has lost extraordinary amounts of weight, has stopped taking care of themselves in terms of hygiene. And it's a process that looks like a 30-year process, but it's done in 6 months to a year. And we started in Montana with the design criteria of when successful, we would roll it out to additional states.
And how many states now, and where do you go from here?
Currently, we have 5 state projects up and running. My guess is we'll be in 12 states by the end of this calendar year.
Chris Rose, Executive Director of the Meth Project, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Olympic track and field kicks into gear in Beijing Friday with the first heats in the men's 100 meters and finals in the men's shot put and the woman's 10,000-meter run. Ambi Burfoot is editor-at-large at Runner's World magazine. He joins us from Beijing. And, Ambi, what events are you really looking forward to?
Well, I think everyone tomorrow is very excited about the men's 100 because we've got this kind of titanic three-way matchup shaping up between Tyson Gay from the U.S. and the Jamaicans, Asafa Powell and Usain Bolt. And, of course, I'm also very interested in the women's 10,000 meters later in the evening.
Tell us a little bit about this titanic three-way race in the 100-meter race.
You know, we've got this group of guys who are all running incredibly fast times, kind of batting the world record back and forth, and now they meet on the Olympic stage. And it's not clear if it'll be a challenge of speed or of nerves who can stand up to the pressure, but it's certainly going to be exciting.
You know, you mentioned Jamaican sprinters Asafa Powell and Usain Bolt, and this sort of brings up the issue a little bit of the performance-enhancing drug issue, which has been throughout the Olympics so far. The International Olympic Committee says it's going to conduct 4,500 drug tests of Olympic athletes during the Games, and the Jamaican sprinters, Asafa Powell and Usain Bolt, say that they're getting tested as many as three or four times in the last 2 weeks. And they're saying that could affect their performance. Do you think that that level of drug testing could affect their performance?
I certainly hope that it would not. And by the way, Tyson Gay, after he had been here for a couple of days, said that he was blood tested once and urine tested once. So they're not singling out the Jamaicans. They may be looking at the guys who are all very fast.
Tell us also about Bernard Lagat. He's one of the favorites in the 1,500 meters, and this is his first Olympics as a U.S. citizen.
It is his first Olympics as a U.S. citizen. He's been at the Olympics twice before, representing Kenya, where he was born. And he's an exciting story because he's not just running the 1,500, but he's doubling back in the 5,000 meters also, trying to do an Olympic double that's only been done a couple of times in history. So his work is more than cut out for him.
And what about the women? Who should we be looking at, watching in the women's races?
Tomorrow night, we've got a final right away in the 10,000 meters with a couple of great American women, Shalane Flanagan and Kara Goucher. But it must be said they're competing against a large group of very, very fast Ethiopians and Kenyans, and to win a medal for them would be a supreme achievement. And then on Sunday morning here, Saturday night primetime TV is the women's marathon, which will be terrific because Dina Castor, who won the bronze 4 years ago in Athens, is hoping to step up even higher on the victory platform this time and perhaps go all the way for the gold.
You think she can win it?
I don't know if she can win it again. It's incredibly difficult. The field is so loaded. It's got Paula Radcliffe running, even though she's had injuries. It's got top Japanese and Chinese and, again, Ethiopian and Kenyan athletes. But Dina does have a way of rising to the occasion, so I think she's in the hunt.
You know, I just want to go back to the performance-enhancing drug issue for a moment. You don't think, Ambi, that the level of testing is affecting runners' performance at all?
I don't think it should be. Bernard Lagat, who was also tested when he was here, said they told him that even the blood withdrawal, that his body would respond and make the equivalent volume of blood in like 4 hours' time. And as he said, you know, if it's 4 hours that I've got to give to help clean up this sport, then that's 4 hours well spent.
You know, we've heard a lot about the air pollution in Beijing. You're a distance runner, and you've been running there. What's it like?
It's incredibly humid. I did grow up on the humid east coast of the U.S., and most days here are equivalent to just about the worst humidity on the east coast. I've run up to 90 minutes at a time, not at an Olympic pace, to be sure. But I have to say my throat is not burning. My eyes are not watering. I don't have dust and other particles on my teeth. It seems like it's just pure but horrendous humidity.
All right. Well, enjoy, Ambi.
You bet.
Ambi Burfoot is editor-at-large for Runner's World magazine. He spoke with us from Beijing, and you can read his Beijing blog by going to our website, here-now.org. After a break, we'll meet a 91-year-old tennis champion. That's coming up here and now. After picking up the 10th medal of her Olympic career, 41-year-old swimmer Dara Torres is preparing for her next event, Friday's 50-meter freestyle. Last Sunday, Torres anchored the U.S. team to the silver medal in the 400-meter freestyle relay, and her participation in these games has sparked a conversation about age. And when it comes to older athletes, 41 is nothing. How about playing competitive tennis into your 90s? Robin Young, who is not in her 90s, is off this week, but she left us this report.
Yeah, great point.
This summer, the U.S. Tennis Association held its national senior men's hardcourt championship at the Mission Hills Country Club in Rancho Mirage, California. This year, for the first time, there was a match for players 95 and older. And this is the finals after a week of fierce competition for the 90 to 95-year-olds.
Great shot.
91-year-old Alex Swetka of Mountain View, California, is facing 92-year-old Federico Barbaza of Argentina. In the stands is Alex Swetka's late 80-something wife, Alice, like a character out of Tale of Two Cities.
Now I notice that you're knitting while you watch.
Madame Lafarge, she was a knitter who knit well, though the armies were killing each other.
At this point, these two men have played each other for decades in competitions around the world. This is not your grandfather's tennis, unless he could hit a drop shot or really run like Alex can.
Do you worry for him?
Only in the finals of a national. But otherwise, he can take care of himself. And if he loses, he always says there's another tournament coming up.
You are unbelievable.
We liked that first set yesterday.
Thank you so much.
But Alex Swetka doesn't lose today. He rarely loses. After the match, he and a disappointed Barbaza are swarmed by the other players in the 90s division.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What do you think the key to the game was?
Watching the ball. You've been doing it for years and years, so continue to do it.
Yeah. Why is it important to keep playing, to keep trying in your 90s?
Well, because I don't feel old. I still feel young, and I can move, I can run, the same as I was 20 years before. I don't have symptoms of oldness, see?
As you become a super senior, the movement is very important. If you can't move that well, while you can, that drop shot is very effective in the super seniors.
The drop shot goes right over the net, and when you're further back in the court, you got to run up and get it.
What you try to do.
Now, we have another older gentleman here. How old are you?
92.
Oh, my gosh. What's it like for you others in the 90s to watch Alex compete?
Oh, it's a pleasure always just to watch a master playing tennis.
Oh, thank you very much.
Is there going to be a 100s?
There's a 95 now, you know.
Yeah.
105 years from now.
I think that there are several contributions to seeing more and more amazing masters athletes.
Dr. Vonda Wright is director of the Performance and Research Initiative for Masters Athletes at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
Number one, we're living longer. But fitness and aging actively and being amazing at any age is something that's really catching on right now. So people like Alex, they are not anomalies. Every other summer, there is an amazing competition called the National Senior Games, which is really Senior Olympics. And when we had them in Pittsburgh in 2005, there were actually 11,000 masters athletes from the age of 50 to 103 doing extraordinary things. Part of that is a perception of what aging is. You know, you think of aging as, oh, at some point you're going to acquire a walker. For some people, that is aging. But for many people who really strategically plan how to stay active, how to make our muscles stronger, it doesn't have to be the picture of aging at all.
So are you saying that masters athletes like Alex, they allow themselves the possibility of playing?
Yes and yes. Number one, I think it's a mindset that people believe that they no longer are just going to slide down a slope from vitality to frailty. But number two, the more science we know that although we do lose muscle mass with age, we do lose bone mass, we do become stiffer, that many of the problems we typically see with aging are very reversible. I did a study recently which looked at performance in track and field, really answering the question, how fast do we age and at what point does biology take over? And I found that from 50 to 75, we decline very, very slowly. But at 75, I call it biology taking over, we really do start to see profound differences in our ability to perform. But let's put that in perspective. A 50-year-old man running in the Senior Olympics will win his mile race in 4 minutes and 34 seconds. That is more amazing than many high school kids will run. The 70-year-old winner of this mile will win his race in 7 minutes, which is faster than many couch potato 30-year-olds will run. So we are capable of so much if we just ask our bodies to keep up.
What is the one thing you would tell someone if they want to prepare?
Number one, you have to be strategic. Plan your physical aging the same way you plan your financial future. Invest every single day. Number two, over 40, we need to do aerobic exercise. Number three, we need to, what I call, carry a load, which means resistance training. And number four, we need to work on our flexibility every single day.
Flexibility every day?
Every day. You only need to do 5 repetitions and hold the stretch for 30 seconds for each muscle group because you get the most stretch from the first stretch.
Huh. Dr. Vonda Wright, Director of the Performance and Research Initiative for Masters Athletes at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, back in Rancho Mirage, 91-year-old Alex Swetka is showing me his stuff.
What's your shot?
My best shot? Yeah. I don't know. The drop shot against super seniors. That's my best shot. Yeah.
What do you do to keep loose?
I do about 20 minutes of calisthenics for my back. One thing about tennis is that you never have reached the end of the line where you say, I've got it. You learn not to let up. So,
is there a metaphor there, Alex, for life? Is that?
Keep working on life and try to improve on it, try to be a better person.
How hard is it, though, to see the ranks thin?
I guess it's life. I say stay healthy. That's the big thing about a super senior.
It reminds me of a story. They were playing in the 80s at Longwood, you know, the famous tennis club in Boston.
Chestnut Hill.
One fellow just right there during a match had a heart attack and he died. And the officials came out and they wanted the guys to all stop their matches. And they said, no, he did what he was loving. And
That's right. Yeah.
You feel that way?
Oh, yes. I'd be out there playing. You love the game so much that... It doesn't, you know, that if you did pass away on the court, why, so what, you know, the best way to go.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Alex.
Well, I got to get a picture of this.
You betcha. I've followed your career for years and years. This is the most wonderful thing to have exposure to this kind of athleticism at your age. It's absolutely fabulous.
Thank you.
You are my hero that there is such athleticism available at this age. It's very inspiring.
I need you to get next to each other. There you go. Perfect. Let me get a close-up of you two. All right, ready? Got it.
Wow.
Wonderful. Oh, it was so nice to meet you.
Thank you.
91-year-old Alex Swetka and his adoring fans after he won the men's 90 and over division finals at the USTA National Senior Hardcourt Championship this summer. Our piece was produced by Here and Now's Robin Young. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.